Good afternoon. It's between morning and noon, so have both. We have the honor here to have the Minister of, you know, to translate it into English, Interior Security. It's a wrong, wrong translation. It's Homeland Security. Mr. Avi Dichter, I have a list here of his career, and I must say that first of all, Avi is there are few people around the administration that you can trust as friends, and Avi is one of them. And for me, is the best reputation because you know when questions are coming to the corner in which you have to decide what is more important than anything, is I think that to have friends like Avi is more important than anything else. But he has a very impressive career in the past. He was the head of the Interior Security Organization of Israel, the Shabak, which is the equivalent of the combination of both FBI and MI5. He then moved to the politics and became one of the most prominent ministers in this government. And he has a very good basis to understand the situation more than any many other Israelis, because the viewpoints that he had in the past and the capability to judge it from the present one is very unique. And I think that we have a very good opportunity here to hear from one of those who really understand the situation, some words about the situation, and in this complicated time, it's very important. Avi, the floor is yours. Here is the if you have something which is that you want to give them the opportunity to ask questions at the end, it's okay. The time is yours, and at the end we give the audience the opportunity to ask questions. And the floor is yours. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you very much. You may sit over here. It's the same price as here. Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Yaakov Amidror, which is an old friend and a friend that we, I believe, fought together for many years in different positions, in many, many arguments. And those who know Yaakov Amidror know that it's not easy to argue with Amidror, especially when he lose.
It never happened, so...
Well, such problem of memory starts in an older... another argument. Anyway... When I got the subject that the audience here are interested to listen to, which is the interior security in the age of global jihadism, and I'm going to elaborate on it in a minute, but the only thing that frightens me is the fact that some of you might understand that I'm going to talk about the internal stability of the state of Israel. I'm sorry for my voice. I've lost it at the last 2 days, but we'll try to do our best. Anyway, I'm not going to talk about the internal stability in Israel because no arguments about the stability of the state of Israel. First, because we are a democracy. And second, because we are 36 parties in Israel. Each party is split to some more splits, which means that such a superpower in terms of parties and splits is stable enough, although I know that many of you probably heard the story that people are telling about Israel or Israelis, and it says about a gap in the forest in Africa when a Lufthansa jet landed an emergency landing and 200 passengers were taken by the cannibals that are around this gap in the forest. They took them to the chief, asked them, "Chief, what are we going to do with those 200 people? And chief said, We're going to feed them for a week and then a party. A few months later, an Air France jet with 300 passengers landed an emergency landing, and all 300 passengers were taken by the cannibals to the chief and asked him, "Chief, what are you going to do with 300 people?" And the chief said, "One week feeding, and then we are going to celebrate." And a few months later, an El Al jet with 450 passengers landed an emergency landing in this gap in the forest. All 450 passengers left the aircraft safe and sound and were taken by the cannibals to the chief. And the chief looked at them and they asked him, "Chief, what are we going to do with them? 450 passengers." And he said, "Party tonight." They said, "How come? What about a week feeding?" He said, "No, these are Israelis. If we leave them for a week, they're going to eat each other alive." So that's the story. In real life, it works completely different. The more fragments we have, the more parties we have, and the more variety of thoughts and views we have, the stronger we are. And during the last maybe 15 years, when we started to talk about the Middle East, about our Middle East, with the neighbors, with the close neighbors, Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and Egypt. So since 1982, we have a peace agreement with Egypt. 1994, a peace agreement with Jordan. And we still used to talk about the Middle East, about our Middle East, with Syria and Lebanon, hoping that one day we'll have the same peace agreement with both. But I think that during the last maybe 7-10 years, we started to talk about a different Middle East, a wider Middle East. And it's not a Middle East that ends in Iraq, east of Jordan and Syria, but it's a Middle East that ends in Iran. And the new player, Iran, which from my point of view is the biggest state of terror exists in this world, it's a new situation. Because if we analyze the situation in the Middle East, talking about Iran in the east of that region, so we can see that Iran is activating against our Middle East, against Israel, with two arms. One of them is the northern arm, and the other is the southern one. The northern arm started to be built at the end of the 80s by Hezbollah, that became a finger in the Iranian palm and increased and became a palm in the Iranian hand and then a hand in the Iranian system. I would call the Hezbollah, that used to be a terror organization, I prefer the term Iran is an army of terrorists. It's an army because it has all capabilities and all infrastructure that an army has. Sponsored by Iran, guided, trained by Iran, Revolutionary Guards trainers are in Lebanon, and Hezbollah terrorists are going to Iran to be trained over there. Capabilities, the state of the art, are being launched from Iran via Syria into Lebanon, or from Syria itself into Lebanon. And we have faced this kind of weapons during the last war in last July, August, in the north part of Israel. So that's why I call them an army. Terrorists, because they still use the main systems that terrorists are using. Fighting from within villages, trying to be surrounded by civilians, that they use them as a human shield in order to protect them and to prevent Israelis from attacking back, and using the system of kidnapping, and it happened several times. It succeeded in July when they kidnapped the two Israeli soldiers Regev and Goldwasser, just a few weeks after the Hamas in Gaza Strip kidnapped Gilad Shalit. The northern arm, Hezbollah, as we all understand, conquered part of Lebanon, because South Lebanon, and I had the honor to spend a year in South Lebanon when Israel was there in the 80s, South Lebanon is conquered by Hezbollah, which means by Iran. Part of the Pekaa Valley is conquered by Hezbollah, means Iran. And some neighborhoods in Beirut itself are conquered by Hezbollah, means Iran, which means that the Lebanese army and the Lebanese police is not authorized to get in these neighborhoods unless Hezbollah enable them to do so. I'm not going to elaborate on the axis that Iran is trying to build from Iran via Iraq, Syria, towards Lebanon. We all know the people, the tribes, or the fact that Iran is, I think, 90% Shiite. Iraq is 60% Shiite. Lebanon is 40% Shiite. And Syria is Shiite less. But the Alawites in Syria, 10%, as we all know, the Imam of the Alawites, King Ali, Imam Ali, was the father of Imam Hussein, the Imam of the Shiites. So it makes it closer and easier for the Shiites, for Iran, to build the access via or through Syria to Lebanon. But what is important for us here in Israel is the fact that Iran holds a battalion called Hezbollah in Lebanon, mainly in the south part of Lebanon, trying to create a threat, a direct threat, towards Israel. It was supposed to be a strategical threat. That was the plan, and that was the way that they built this battalion until the last war. Unfortunately, from their side, and fortunately from our side, after that session of violence, the war in South Lebanon, North Israel, we have seen that what was supposed to be a strategical weapon, I mean 4,000 missiles and rockets launched from Lebanon towards Israel, 4,000, whether it's Katyusha rockets or the Syrian rockets, hit many areas in Israel, killed 53 Israelis. Unfortunately, we know that in Israel, in some suicide bombings, if we take just a pair of suicide bombings, we suffer the same number of fatalities. So I wouldn't call it a strategical weapon, although it bothered us and it caused million citizens in Israel to change their life for 33 days. But I wouldn't call it a strategical weapon, and I believe that neither Hezbollah nor Iran is calling it a strategical weapon. And the best statement that something has been changed in terms of the deterrence between Israel towards Hezbollah is the unique statement given by Hassan Nasrallah at the end of the war, said, if I knew that that's going to be the Israeli response to the kidnapping of the two soldiers, I wouldn't have given the order to kidnap the two soldiers. It was a unique statement, never been repeated, and I think it indicates firmly the way that Hassan Nasrallah and many other people see the situation after the war. Just to conclude this issue, if United Nations Resolution 1701 was put, from my point of view, if it was put in front of the Israeli government on July 12th, I think that no reason to launch the attacks in Lebanon against Hezbollah, whether in South Lebanon or in Beirut itself. Because 1701 contains all points that if the Lebanese government, of the Lebanese authorities and Israel, under the international umbrella, if all points from this 1701 United Nations resolution is being implemented and translated into action items, I think that we can enter today a new peace process with the state of Lebanon. The problem, of course, that despite many international troops in Lebanon, we see that many of those points in 1701 resolution is still far from being implemented. But I believe that the level of deterrence that Israel created towards Hezbollah is probably the main positive issue that we have gained from the last war in Lebanon. So that's the northern arm. The southern arm starts in Iran, goes through Damascus, and ends in the Gaza Strip. It was supposed to end in both Gaza Strip and the West Bank. But Israel, since March 2002, since the horrible terror attack at the Passover night in March 2002, we have changed our strategy against the terrorists in the West Bank. Because the West Bank, during all these years of violence, creates the biggest number of losses and injuries to the Israeli civilians. If we just take the last term since the disengagement till today, and although some people believe that we are suffering the biggest number of casualties from terror attacks launched from the Gaza Strip, so I must tell you that the facts shows a different issue. 85% of our casualties, losses and injuries, are due to terror attacks launched from the West Bank, even today. Which means that 1,400 Qassam rockets that were launched from the Gaza Strip towards Israel, since we have left the whole Gaza Strip and withdrew from the Philadelphia corridor, the line between Gaza Strip and Egypt. Despite that step and 1,400 Qassam rockets launched towards Israel till today, we've suffered two fatalities in Sderot in 1 week, and the majority of our casualties are due to terror attacks launched from the West Bank. We had the same proportions, even more than 90% of our losses at the first 2 years of Intifada were from terror attacks from the Gaza, from the West Bank, and that pushed us to change the Israeli strategy against terrorists in the West Bank. And since then, since defensive field operation was launched April 02, till today, we have changed dramatically the situation in the West Bank. So Iran and Hamas got married in about 2001. The external leadership of Hamas, led by Khaled Mashal, sits in Damascus for many years, next to the leadership and the headquarters of PIJ, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, that sits also in Damascus since 1994. So both headquarters, and especially Khaled Mashal as the external leader of Hamas, started to increase the level of coordination and cooperation with Iran since 2001. Iran tried, by the way, to build and to base this kind of coordination indirectly by Hezbollah, as they did between Iran and the PIJ, Palestinian Islamic Jihad. But it didn't work because Hamas refused to be coordinated by Hezbollah and insisted that they will have a direct link to the Revolutionary Guards and the Ministry of Intelligence in Tehran. Since 2001, we can see the increase of level of coordination, and Khaled Mashal is a frequent flyer from Damascus to Tehran, and when he used to go to meet with Abu Mazen as the prime minister under the late Arafat, he used to go from Damascus to Tehran to coordinate his positions and then to go to Cairo or to Yemen to meet with Abu Mazen and to decide about a period of calm, a ceasefire, or any other understandings. This level of coordination increased dramatically over the last years. Iran started to train terrorists from Hamas, from the Gaza Strip, that after the disengagement had the opportunity to cross from Gaza into Egypt and from Egypt to take off to Tehran, to be trained over there and to go back to the Gaza Strip, enhanced with Iranian trainings. Parallel to that, during all session of violence at the last years, a flow of smuggling from Sinai into Gaza Strip equipped them with a lot of means of warfare, anti-tank rockets, some of anti-aircraft rockets, Strela, a lot of ammunition, explosives, tons, 10 tons of explosives. And Hamas built itself in Gaza Strip at this, on the same basic that Hezbollah is built in Lebanon. The emulation of Hezbollah in Gaza Strip is almost one by one. Therefore, when we look at those two arms, so the northern arm, Hezbollah in Lebanon, that we had a very tough session of violence with, and I believe that it created a new level of deterrence towards them. Hamas in Gaza Strip, which till today we had some period of calms, but I don't think that we have expressed our level of deterrence towards Hamas, and I hope we won't need to do such a step, but if it will be needed, we know how to do that. We have all capabilities, all knowledge, how to create a new level of deterrence towards Hamas in Gaza Strip. So the minute they think that they might open a new session of violence against Israel, they know it's not going to pay off. They know it's going to be a disaster to Hamas in the Gaza Strip, same as it happened to Hamas in the West Bank. Now the question, of course, is what's going to win? The PA, led by Abu Mazen and Fatah staff, in both West Bank and Gaza Strip, or the pressure made by Iran towards Hamas in Gaza Strip especially, in order to create a new situation in the West Bank, in the Gaza Strip and in the West Bank, but especially to try to change the regime in the PA from a Fatah regime into an authority that is led by Hamas leaders, of course, instead of Abu Mazen. As I said before, in the West Bank, we've succeeded to create a new situation, which probably assists Fatah movement because many of Hamas terrorists in the West Bank were rooted out and were put in jail. But we all understand that it's not enough to have a different area, and all you need to do as a leader of the Palestinian Authority is to make sure that your troops, your apparatuses, your security apparatuses are controlling what's going on in terms of creating terror against Israel, because it's well understood to Abu Mazen and his people. Once the West Bank is going to repeat and to continue to launch terror attacks against Israel, the situation, even in the West Bank, is going to be different than it is today. We're not going to ease the pressure. We are going to put an additional pressure, because Israel is not going to bleed for Abu Mazen. We are not going to count our fatalities. We are not going to count our injuries and to say and to tell everyone that we are biting our lips until Abu Mazen will build his own security troops. That's for sure not going to happen. We have done it for many years. When Yasser Arafat was chairman and Abu Mazen was number two, and we paid during the first 3 years of Intifada 900 fatalities. 900 fatalities in 3 years. Almost all of them civilians. Just try to put it in your country's figures and you understand what does it mean. I think in Australian figures it's 30,000-40,000, a little less. In American figures it's close to 50,000 fatalities. Just try to imagine in Great Britain, which is 10 times bigger than Israel, 9,000 fatalities in 3 years. And we thought that it's going to work with the PA under Yasser Arafat, and we failed. And when we decided to change the situation, as I said before, during the Defensive Shield operation, till today, we have changed it dramatically towards the West Bank, and we cut down dramatically the number of our losses over the last 3 years, 3.5 years. But that's when we talk about the conventional aspects concerning with Iran. But Iran became a different player in the whole region. Iran sits on the edge between the Muslim countries and the Muslim Arab countries. Iran is not an Arab country. And the threat that Iran creates towards the Arab world is something that we all can understand, and especially Saudi Arabia, Gulf countries, Jordan, Egypt, and maybe some other Arab countries do understand that the threat that Iran creates by trying to reach nuclear capabilities and the nuclear bomb and missiles to launch this kind of weapon towards other countries. Today we hear about 1,500 kilometers missiles, 3,000 kilometer missiles, which means it's not the state of Israel. It's probably other targets, whether Arab countries, maybe European countries, maybe other countries, nobody knows. But when we talk about Iran, so we know as a state of Israel that despite some Israelis will tell you that we are a superpower, so I may tell you we are not. We are a state. We know how to defend ourselves. We have done it before. We'll do it in the future. But we are not a superpower. We have reached a time that now it's the superpowers era. Concerning with the new threat launched by Iran, I think that the superpower, whether the EU countries, the United States, Russia, and maybe other countries, must understand that Iran is not a normal country. I'm in this business of counterterrorism during the last 36 years, since I was recruited to the army when I was 18 years old. I thought that I've seen everything in terms of using or abusing people in order to create terror attacks. But I remember very well 25, 26 years ago when Iran regime, when Iran's leadership, the same leadership that leads Iran today, were they sent into the battlefield against Iraq, kids of 12 years old, to clear and to clean fields of mines with their bodies. And the regime leaders who are ready to send kids of 12 years old just to blow up themselves in order to prevent any detonation of mines with their bodies, and to enable troops, military troops, to go forward, I would say that's not a normal country. Therefore, when superpowers, or even states, but let alone superpowers, when they think about Iran, when they think about the probability that Iran is going to have nuclear bomb, I think that we must all think about a state of terror that used kids, as I said before. So the thoughts about what might be happening if they are reaching a nuclear bomb, it's not a different story, it's a dangerous story. Going back to the region here, and I want to sum up with it, and to open the meeting to questions, if there are some. I would say that over the last years, we can see that terror attacks is not anymore terrorists from within one country against targets in the other country. We can see how it works in networks. And when terror is being built with networks, the only way, and probably the best way, to fight this kind of networks of terror is by creating networks of countries who are determined to counter terrorism, to counter terror. That's probably the name of the game and the key success factor by the normal countries once they are determined to counter terror. That's what we are trying to do with our allies. That's what I think must be done towards those countries and towards those areas that belong to countries that were handed over to terror organizations, whether it's Osama bin Laden or Global Jihad or Hezbollah or Hamas or any other names. Because that's probably the best way, and I'm afraid it's the only way, to fight this kind of terror attacks and to fight and to win the battle against this kind of terror organizations. Here between us and the PA, and I know that everybody is anxious to understand what's going to happen here in the Middle East between Israel and the PA. As I said, I'm 36 years in this business and 31 years with living and talking with Palestinians. I spent more years in Gaza than I spent in Tel Aviv. I think I know them very well, whether they belong to Fatah movement, to PIJ, to Hamas, or to the others. So the probability that I see, the probability to set up an agreement, a peace agreement, and a peace situation between Israel and the PA is much stronger than the probability that we are going to get into another round of violence against and with the PA. And that's the way I see it. That's the way I believe it. And as far as I can, that's the way I'm going to lead it. Thank you very much.
I'm glad that it was, at the end, we had some optimistic remarks about the future. I'm not sure that I share all of them. But anyhow, now it's questions for you. Please identify yourself for the history, and then you can ask the question. Yes, please.
Yes. Steve Goodkin from the Associated Press. Yeah. The mic.
Steve Goodkin from the Associated Press. Can you explain your optimism at the end? Because after hearing about the two arms and Iran's influence in the southern part and the northern front, why do you feel that the possibility for some sort of a peaceful agreement is bigger than the possibility of renewed confrontation?
No, I prefer to answer. I think it's easier. It's better for me to talk when I'm standing. And anyway, about optimism and what Yaakov Amidros said. First of all, it's a huge advance, Yaakov, that you said that you don't agree with all what I've said, with part of what I said, because normally you used to say that you don't agree with all what I said. So. Anyway. Anyway, in the Middle East, here in Israel, when we try to identify who is an optimist, so we say it's a pessimist with experience. So that's what I feel. You know, sometimes when you are sure that we are in a chaos, we are in a turmoil, that nothing is going to come out of it. And I remember September 1993. I was in charge of the Southern Division in my former organization, Shin Bet. And around 8th, 9th of September, my boss, the head of Shin Bet, called me and said, Avi, it's going to be signed an agreement between us and the Palestinians, Yasser Arafat, after months of meetings in Oslo. And you, me, which means the one who was in charge to catch and to bring to prison all fugitives from Gaza Strip, you have to create a different situation in Gaza, and you have to start talking with them, with the leaders of Fatah and the Front Liberation Organization, Hamas, and all the others. Just like that. And we called our enemies. We called them. Hello? It's Avi. And he answered, I am the name of the fugitive, the leader of them. You probably heard about the Oslo Agreement, and you probably got the instructions from your boss, from Yasser Arafat, same as I got from my boss that got it from the late Rabin. And we have to sit and to set up all issues concerning with the fugitives, hundreds of them. My people told me, Avi, you're crazy. How are we going to do it? I said, I don't know. But that's what we're supposed to do. So let's meet them where? Said at our headquarters. And they came to our headquarters. Same people that we ran after, same people that opened fire towards us, same people that killed and injured Israelis just days before, and gave orders to launch terror attacks against Israelis. And we did it in days, not in months, not in years. And it brings me back to the interests of both people. You know, I know that some Israelis, it's very difficult for them to think the right way. And in some cases, I used to give instructions to my people in my former job. I told them, if you want to know what's going to be done by the fugitives, try to think as an Israeli and do the opposite. So you'll meet his steps. Anyway, I think that the interests of the Palestinians, and we speak about 1.2 million people in Gaza Strip, and probably 1.6, 1.7 in the West Bank. They know that they have no chance to build themselves as a nation without a peace agreement with Israel. No chance. Even if it will take hundreds of years of combat, no way that Israel will enable them to hit Israelis and to become a nation that sits safe and sound. And we have two regions, as I said before. West Bank with one atmosphere, Gaza Strip with another. The Palestinian people, the majority, are not that extremist as Hamas. And if you sit with Palestinians and ask them about the new link between Iran and Sunnis, Arabs, in the PA, I can assure you that a tough objection will be heard. Therefore, I know that the barrier, probably, is the way that Hamas is touched with the Iranian Revolutionary Guards after 6 or 7 years. And the external leadership of Hamas in Damascus is much more extremist than the leadership in Gaza Strip. Because, as we all understand, those who count the lashes are not like those who are suffering it. And Khaled Mash'al and his people in Damascus, they don't remember, maybe Khaled himself remember it, but the others, they don't remember what does it mean to live in Gaza Strip, to launch terror attacks against Israel, but to suffer heavy attacks and accurate attacks against them. So I'm sure that even the Palestinians, even the Fatah, or even the Hamas extremists, they know very well that there are no other ways to live safe and sound in Gaza Strip without a peace agreement with Israel. Now, some people say, because Israel is still into the PA land, that's the reason, that's the cause for terror attacks. It doesn't work with Gaza Strip. We have left August 05. We disengaged totally from the Gaza Strip. We are not there. We're not there anymore. We don't have even one Israeli, especially Gilad Shalit that was kidnapped. We don't have one Israeli in Gaza Strip. We have disengaged from the Philadelphia corridor, which enabled the PA to be attached directly to Egypt. And nevertheless, as I said before, 1,400 Qassam rockets were launched. What did they achieve with those 1,400 Qassam rockets? Zero. A tough pressure by the EU quartet countries and many other countries. A tough rejection by the United Nations. And I think a tough response by the State of Israel whenever we found it necessary. So that's why I ended my talk with an optimistic phrase, not just to leave you with an optimistic statement, just because I do believe that 2.8 million people have some common interests with the State of Israel, with the Israelis, and the question is how to get back to the situation that we have faced just 7 years ago. And if we did it in 1993, I'm sure there is a strong possibility to repeat it again.
Yes, please. For the microphone, please.
I'm from South Africa. Firstly, I'll start with a comment. I think from the beginning when I arrived here, I said there's going to be peace. I even went as far to say in 2 years' time. But now I'm convinced before I leave, which is next year, June, there will be peace in this part of the world. But it's difficult to tell what kind of a peace will be signed. And then the question is, don't you think in Israel you need what I'll refer to as a strategist like Mandela? Why do I say that? You know, in 1990 when the ANC was unbanned and then declared, took over, if you look deep and analyze the history of that period, you'll find out many, many people, I'm talking about blacks, were murdered, were slaughtered, more than the entire liberation struggle. And many of us who came from exile were convinced that the time was not ripe for negotiations. Everybody was saying, let's abandon this. But Mandela said, no, we're moving forward. In the midst of those killings, don't you think in Israel there are times when, maybe through anger, you look on one side of the coin, not on both sides. As a result, you lose the opportunity just to take one step and you achieve this peace. Don't you think now is the time to sit back, not to be driven by emotions, even when there are some attacks, unnecessary attacks, to say these are sideshows. All we need is peace. Thank you.
Well, first of all, I beg to differ, but the comparison to the situation here compared to South Africa, it's simply, from my point of view, incorrect. It's not that the Palestinians are living under our sovereignty or our responsibility. As I said before, and we all know, in the year 1993 or 1994, we handed over to Yasser Arafat and his people the authorization in Gaza Strip and in the West Bank. The detailed agreement of Oslo goes step by step, to further steps and to further steps until a full peace agreement between Israel and the Palestinian Authority. Same as it happened between Israel and Egypt, that went since 1977 up to 1982. You know that some people in the Palestinian Authority and Israel believe that Marwan Barghouti is Nelson Mandela. They try to call him under this name. Marwan Barghouti is in Israeli jail. But in many of my meetings with high-ranking leaders from the PA, they told me, Avi, we were wrong in two issues that we tried to raise. First of all, Yasser Arafat is not David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister of Israel that established the country and declared the establishing of the State of Israel in May 1948. And he said because he simply didn't declare of a Palestinian statement, of Palestinian state. Nobody knows the reason why Yasser Arafat didn't decided to state the Palestinian state. And the second issue, when they try to compare Marwan Barghouti to Nelson Mandela. Marwan Barghouti was sentenced for 5 life imprisonment because he sent people to murder 5 Israelis. As a matter of fact, they murdered 4 Israelis and a priest that they supposed he's an Israeli on the way to Jericho. And he was sentenced for 5 life imprisonment. And it's well understood why there's nothing to compare between him and Nelson Mandela once you mention the name. In Israel, at the conflict between Israel and the Arabs in Israel, it depends where you decide to start. And with your permission, I'll take you back to 1947, the partition plan that was put in front of the Israelis and the Arabs in Israel offered to divide the state of Israel between the two people. The partition plan gave the state of Israel less than 2/3 of the state of Israel that was established finally in 1948. Less than 2/3. Nevertheless, the prime minister or the leader at that day, David Ben-Gurion, agreed. Israel's response was, yes, the Palestinians, at that time they were called the Israeli Arabs, was not. And then the independence war opened. To your knowledge, during the independence war, we have lost 1% of our people here in Israel. From 600,000 people, we have lost 6,000 people in the independence war. It's not easy. Neither for us, nor for everyone. But nevertheless, we continued. In 1993, when the Oslo Agreement was signed in Oslo and then in Washington, the White House, we thought that we are on the right path. I myself, since then, was in many jobs, including head of the organization that used to discuss daily with my colleagues. And I know that sometimes details are not that important. And if you want to see the whole picture, don't look at the details. But as we all understand, the devil is in the details. And we tried during the 7 years of violence. And I remember October 2000, right after the Intifada broke out. A summit was held in Sharm el-Sheikh with all leaders of the world, from the United States and the United Nations and Russia and Jordan and Egypt and Israel and the Palestinian Authority. And since then, session after session, meetings after meeting, with delegations and leaders from the EU and from the United States trying to create a new situation between us and the PA. And because we are a strong country, we were very moderate in some of the, and very generous in some of the things that we hand over to the Palestinians, to those Palestinians that are still leading in the PA. And nevertheless, the only thing that we expected them to do is just one thing. Don't let Palestinians, terrorists, murder Israelis by yourself, by your troops. And we were waiting 2 years to see how it's going to happen. And when you suffer 700 fatalities, you understand that it's not going to happen. So I know that it frustrates something, and it frustrates many people. But frustration for myself and for many Israelis who are in charge, frustration is not a work plan. Frustration is a feeling. And we have to put on the table work plans, one after the other. If one fails, we'll put another one, and another one, and another one. And we're still young. We have time. We're going to make sure that when we say two states, neighbors, in peace, it's going to be in peace. And not two states, that one state is trying to defend itself and the other is doing nothing in terms of fighting against terrorists. That never happened in other countries. It will never happen here. And I think that our partners from the Palestinian side know very well what's our limits, what's our deadlines, and what's our red lines. And I'm sure that once they understand it, they know that Israel is ready to go a long way towards them, but not the whole way. Because we have here 7 million people in our country, surrounded with Arab countries. With two of them, we have a peace agreement. Two of them are still creating a threat. And those who are trying to frighten Israel, whether it's from Iran or by its fingers in the region, that Israelis has to go back to the land, to the countries that we came from. We, I mean our parents. My parents came from Poland. Both of them. Today it's the Ukraine. They were very big families. They've lost the whole families during the Holocaust. And they came to Israel. And I don't have any intention to go anywhere. Believe me, it's not going to happen.
Minister Dichter, Dan Dyker, JCPA, I want to return you, if I might, to what I understood the thesis of your talk was, certainly 95% into the talk, which is that the new Middle East that you spoke about is a much more dangerous one than perhaps the one that was talked about during the Oslo years. I'm trying to make sense of what it appears to me to be a dissonance, a sense of dissonance with the end of the conclusion of your talk, which is, as my colleague from the AP spoke about, is a sense of optimism you had with the partnership in the Palestinian Authority. But taking the majority of your talk, which is that essentially there really is no Palestinian Authority in power, but in fact Iran, through its Quds force in Lebanon, through IRGC trainers in Gaza and in Lebanon, and as Mr. Diskin has talked about, enormous penetration of Iranian support and trainers in the West Bank through PIJ and through Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade. In fact, General Gallant said that the Iranians had purchased the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade in a talk here just about 8 days ago. How do we understand that there is any address whatsoever in the Palestinian Authority, even if they had wanted to, in view of the terrible and violent split between the Hamas, which according to you is controlled by Khaled Mashal and not Ismail Haniyeh, and the Fatah, with Iran pulling the strings to our north, to our south, and to our and to our east? How does one come up with a sense that there is anyone in control in the Palestinian Authority areas that Israel might be able to deal with in view of the fact that Iran is still around as a major, as the hegemon in the region?
Thank you, Dan. First of all, it's true that Hamas is controlled by Khaled Mashal. It used to be a debate for many years, who is running the Hamas? Is it Khaled Mashal, the external leader, or Sheikh Yassin, the internal leader? And for many years, they refused to state who is number one. In 2004, when Sheikh Yassin left us, it was the first time that Rantisi, his deputy, for a few hours stated himself as number one. But then he got a message from Damascus, you are not number one. Khaled Mashal is number one. It's the first time that Hamas stated that Khaled Mashal is from now on number one. And they didn't even mention that Rantisi is number two. And then Rantisi left us and so on and so on. Ismail Haniyeh is not the leader of Hamas. He is the prime minister elected due to the fact that he was the right hand of Sheikh Yassin, and because they couldn't stand that Mahmoud al-Zahar or the other, what they call, Mshiginers, which means the crazy people, will lead Hamas. So they preferred to compromise and to take Ismail Haniyeh to lead from the internal region and to become the prime minister. But it's well understood to the external Hamas and to the internal Hamas that Khaled Mashal is the leader of Hamas. He is the one who gives the orders. He is the one who sends the money. He's the leader of Hamas, just to clarify that. And as I said, Khaled Mashal is like Hassan Nasrallah in terms of the relations with Tehran, whether it is the IRG or the Ministry of Intelligence, and trying to implement the Iranian strategy in Gaza Strip, same as Hassan Nasrallah is implementing the Iranian strategy in Lebanon towards Israel. When we talk about Iran, so the sanctions that were put by the United Nations or by the United States and the EU countries, although it's, I would say, a bit poor sanctions in terms of threatening the Iranian regime, but it caused them some kind of fear. It's not that the sanctions just went above Iran and they haven't seen anything. No, we know for sure that they are quite, they do feel that something is, some kind of pressure is being put on Iran. And although Iran is a very strong country in terms of the global oil, you know, Iran is producing, I think, 11% of the global oil, but that's one way to look at it. Because they sit on the straits, they control the Straits of Hormuz, so they control a third of the global oil that goes through the Straits of Hormuz, which gives them not an easy position by controlling a third of the global oil. But that's the court of the superpowers. It's not the court of the states, and of course not the court of the state of Israel. I remember many years ago when I used to go to the states, and we started here what we used to call targeted killings. So in one of my meetings in the states, someone from the American organizations, security apparatuses, told me, Avi, you have to take care about the targeted killings. I said, how come? We have learned it from you in Afghanistan, Yemen, and so on. He said, yes, but there is a difference between superpower and the state. So I asked, what's the difference? He said, a superpower can do almost everything she wants to do. So I asked him, in the state, he said, the state can do a little bit more than the superpower allows it to do. And I checked with the United Nations, we are a state. And we have to know that when we talk about Iran that is trying to send the arms towards Israel and send maybe some other arms towards other countries and to reach some new capabilities, whether from North Korea or from former Soviet Union's countries, and to develop by itself the nuclear bombs, it's another game. It's not the game that we know how to play. It's a different game. We know how to protect ourselves. That's our mission. But talking about Iran, it's not that the state of Israel cannot lead the way of how the world is going to towards Iran or to block Iran from developing its nuclear capabilities. But we can cut the links, or we can make sure that those links that starts in Iran and reaches Lebanon and the Gaza Strip, or maybe West Bank, will be cut by our counterterrorism capabilities and abilities. And it's a question of time. What will happen first? Are we going to get tired? Or they are going to get tired. I can assure you, we are not going to get tired.
Thank you very much. It's the end of the session, and I'm sure that you've got a lot of information. I hope that Avi is right, and at the end of the day, we will find ourselves in a better situation in the Middle East, although it's very clear that it's not going to be an easy ride because of the circumstances. Thank you very much for being with us. Next meeting is the 26th of March with the deputy head of the Bank of Israel. And he will talk about the Israeli economy under the shadow of terrorism and problems. And I hope that we will meet you here for this interesting meeting. Thank you.